Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Madam Speaker, I seek unanimous consent on cars, consumer inflation, and holiday shopping at work. Without objection, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, Wednesday, 18 December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, here is a thing about businesses that kind of gets forgotten sometimes in the rough and tumble of the everyday. Businesses got to make money. And the bigger the business is, the more money it's got to make, which gets us to the big business getting bigger news of the day. Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot, makers among them of Dodge and Ram, Jeep and Alfa Romeo, as well as Peugeot, Citroën and Opel, have announced the final terms of their merger. A company worth $50 billion, the number four car maker by cars sold in the world, which is big. But let's get back to that making money thing, shall we? The automaking business right now is expensive. You got to figure out electric and self-driving for starters. But car sales are lukewarm and more people are sharing cars every day, so profits? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Consumer demand for autos is soft, from North America to Europe to China. There are global trade tensions. And, says Garrett Nelson at CFRA Research,
automakers are really looking for a way to increase their scale, to share the enormous cost associated with electric and autonomous vehicles.
Car makers now have to make massive investments in research and development and engineers, says Carla Bailo at the Center for Automotive Research, to produce for both the current and future market.
An internal combustion engine, many times a hybrid, and now many customers are demanding a pure electric.
Then there's the vehicle of the future's brain, the software, says Ned Hill at the Ohio Manufacturing Institute.
And that's the autonomous driving systems. There's no vehicle brand that wants to give all that money to Google or Apple.
And in the future, a lot of people may not even buy cars. Carla Bailo says the whole industry is moving toward usership rather than ownership, with fleets of electric and autonomous vehicles shared or leased.
I think nobody knows right now, really, if they're going to be profitable with these new business models. We certainly haven't seen many of the startups be profitable yet.
There is one potential bright spot with this shift to non-fossil fuel combustion engines and non-human drivers, says David Whiston at Morningstar.
I do think there is potential for better margins, at least for the firms that survive in that new paradigm. An electric vehicle has a lot fewer parts.
Meaning the cost of materials and labor should eventually go down, leaving more money in the pockets of automakers. Maybe. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Maybe. Okay, so about that making money theme we've got going here, bad things happen when companies don't. And one reason companies don't make money is that the economic ground changes under them and they just can't keep up, or they miss the change entirely. Hello, Federal Express. As we mentioned yesterday, train wreck is not too strong a word for its most recent quarterly earnings. The company's been struggling with global uncertainty. There's been some manufacturing weakness, also a big falling out with Amazon. But really, as Marketplace's Justin Ho explains, this change has been a-coming.
It's not often that you hear a top executive of a public company talk about profits with this kind of language.
We are at the bottom. Our adjusted operating profit decline year over year is horrific.
That was FedEx Freight CEO John A. Smith on a conference call on Tuesday. Horrific profits are a far cry from FedEx's early days in the 70s and 80s when it led the industry with fast overnight delivery.
In this fast-moving, high-pressure, get-it-done-yesterday world, aren't you glad there's one company that can keep up with it all?
You got a deal, good. I'm putting you down to deal with Dick. Dick, what's the deal with the deal? Are we dealing? We're dealing.
Back then, overnight delivery had a key requirement, airplanes. Dale Rogers is a professor of logistics at Arizona State University.
You had to get the stuff to the FedEx office by 5 o'clock. At 7, they'd put the planes in the air, and they'd be at the office before 10:30 in the morning.
Great model when businesses had to mail documents back and forth all the time. But now, e-commerce dominates shipping, and the bulk of that shipping happens on the ground. Satish Jindal at SJ Consulting says that's because shipping companies and retailers like Amazon are using warehouses to store goods closer to consumers,
such that they could do next day without necessarily putting everything in the air.
There's a lot of competition in ground shipping. And delivering bulky packages, especially to people's homes, is costly for delivery companies.
It will take time for them to build the network and get the density to lower the cost of that delivery.
FedEx says it's expanding home deliveries to 7 days a week. In the meantime, it's reducing its flight hours by 8%. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this day of impeachment. Kind of a snoozer, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Time's getting short. We know that. Too much holiday stuff, not enough days left. So, you know, you do what you gotta do. The heck with the company's bottom line. The HR consulting firm Robert Half says about half of employees figure they are going to spend some time shopping online at work this year. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino, it seems, among them.
Yeah, we'll get to that in 1 second. Just gotta finish off this one last gift purchase. Expires 11/21. Shipped billing address. And one 6-quart cast iron Dutch oven coming my way. Here at Marketplace, online shopping on the job is probably frowned upon. Sorry, guys. But at some workplaces, the rules are more black and white.
It's 100% not allowed to use the computers for anything other than work-related purposes.
Andrew works at a government office. We're changing his name to protect him. And he says at first he followed the rules and kept his shopping outside of work. But it just wasn't realistic. He lives in a rural town in Northern California. The nearest Target is 2.5 hours away. So he buys a lot online, especially this time of year.
Still don't abuse the policy, but if there's downtime where you can just hop on for a few minutes, see if there's any deals or anything that you need to snatch up right now.
Like that robot vacuum he got a killer deal on this year. He says he spends probably 15 minutes a day shopping, but that time can really add up, according to a survey of professional workers from productivity software company Zapier.
You know, you see in all segments, all groups, that people are more likely to shop at work than not.
Zapier CEO Wade Foster says it found the majority of workers plan to spend 8 work hours shopping online between Thanksgiving and Christmas this year. An entire workday lost to vacuum reviews and coupon hunting.
It can lead our mind to become a bit more overstimulated. And it's that overstimulation that's the greatest enemy of focus these days.
Chris Bailey is the author of Hyperfocus and the Productivity Project and says online shopping can be pretty distracting, but it's not all bad.
Online shopping can be a curious equation. It definitely saves us time, and it may provide us with a bit more energy because we get that quick hit, that productivity feeling.
Having uncompleted tasks hanging over us, like, say, buying presents, can nag at our attention and reduce productivity. So he says spending those few minutes shopping online can not only save us an hours-long trip to the mall, it can save brain power, too.
I didn't think I'd be such an advocate for online shopping, but we do have to be careful with this attention component of it.
He suggests completing a work task first and then rewarding yourself with a limited amount of online shopping. But you might not want to do it out in the open, says business consultant Alexandra Levitt.
The default is that everyone's going to feel guilty about doing anything personal during business hours because that's how our culture is.
Even as, she says, the line between our work and personal lives is becoming more blurred.
So you may be doing things during work hours that are personal, and likewise, you're probably doing work things during your personal hours.
She says a slowdown at work around the holidays is inevitable, not just because of shopping, but vacations, family parties, school functions, and too much eggnog.
I think that's not the end of the world, and I think just to have an open dialogue sometimes about the fact that this is taking place and that people shouldn't feel like, as a boss, you're looking over their shoulder, or God forbid, the company's monitoring what sites you're going to.
Rather, employers should clearly communicate realistic expectations for what really needs to get done this time of year and not sweat the occasional Dutch oven distraction. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We got the latest readings on inflation about a week ago, the Consumer Price Index, it's called. Turns out we paid a little bit more for stuff in November. So as we do every now and then, a check-in with some listeners who've been keeping track of what they're spending for us, the holiday edition.
This is Ellen Murphy calling from Mission Hills, Kansas. I have been looking at my lists for shopping to make all the holiday meals that are coming up. But I think in general, things seem to be about 15% or so up from last year when I was doing a lot of baking at this time of the year. It's hard to pinpoint particular items because I actually look for them to go on sale. And I usually get them in advance because I plan.
Hi, this is Sudipto Chatterjee from the San Francisco Bay Area. We recently upgraded our kitchen and we were shopping around for cabinets and countertops. We designed and got our kitchen cabinets from IKEA, but got the countertop from a local store because we liked the variety of options more. I saw a sign in at least two of the stores that due to tariffs on China, certain types of quartz countertops were in short supply and they couldn't guarantee when the next one would be available, even though they had a sample on display. On the other hand, IKEA prices were locked, and I knew that they wouldn't go up or down, at least for the year.
Hi, this is Ernesto from Chicago. For the last few years, the price of milk has been constant, specifically for one brand name. It's $3.99 a gallon for whole milk. But at a chain drugstore, it's always been cheaper. Same brand, same gallon, same everything, at about $3.19 a gallon. Kind of a big difference, but starting a few weeks ago, it went up to $3.49 a gallon. I am not sure why the price changed. The brand recently did file for bankruptcy protection, so I don't know if that had something to do with it. But it was curious, and now here I am telling you about it.
Ellen Murphy started us off. She's in Mission Hills, Kansas. Sudipta Chatterjee is from the San Francisco Bay Area. Ernesto, who asked us not to use his last name, is in Chicago. Coming up.
It sounds like I've got a gasket that just sprung a leak. That's, like I said, it's always something.
Making records the old-fashioned way, steam-powered vinyl. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 27 points today, 10%, 28,239. The Nasdaq picked up 4 points. We'll call that unchanged percentage-wise, 88 to 27. S&P 500 also flat, 31 and 91. FedEx, which Justin Ho told you about, was decimated. The actual definition of that word, by the way, look it up, shares down 10%. UPS down 1.9%. Amazon off 0.3%. Food giant General Mills cooked up 1.9% today. The Minneapolis-based company reported quarterly earnings above estimates. Insurance company Cigna advanced 2.4%. It announced a deal to sell its group and life disability insurance to New York Life for $6.3 billion. Simoleon's Pacific Gas and Electric found 3.6% today. U.S. bankruptcy judge approved two PG&E settlements totaling $24.5 billion. That money, of course, to compensate wildfire victims. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace helps you answer questions you've always wondered about, and now that includes finding out more about how and why we do what we do every day. Become a Marketplace investor today, and you'll get exclusive access to a series of virtual AMAs featuring David Brancaccio, Molly Wood, and me, Kai Rizdahl. Don't miss out on our 2020 Ask Me Anything series. Contribute $60 or sign up to donate $5 a month at marketplace.org, and thanks.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, slightly more than 11% of all Americans were food insecure, at least part of the time during 2018. Food insecure being defined here is not having access to enough food for an active, healthy life for everybody in a given household. That's where Feeding America comes in. The second largest charity in the United States is a network of 200 food banks, 60,000 food pantries and meals programs, and 2 million volunteers. Running it all, with a lot of help, of course, is the CEO, Claire Babineau-Fontenot. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
When you are out and about and people say, Claire, what do you do? And you say, I run Feeding America. They say, what's that, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. The good news is they're more inclined to have a sense of what I do now than when I used to tell them I was a tax lawyer. But
okay. Well, say more about that. I mean, you are a product of corporate America who now is running a ginormous nonprofit social services agency.
That's exactly right. I grew up as a lawyer and engaged in various ways using that law license. Including having worked in government and big four accounting. I was in a major law firm, well, major by Louisiana standards. And I was also an executive at Fortune One. So did all of those things. Mm-hmm. Always had a passion for people. I say I have a heart for people and a head for numbers. And the role that I have right now allows me to access both of them at one time.
And you have an enormous challenge. Give us a sense, would you, of the scope of what it is that you're trying to do?
Absolutely. So our vision is a hunger-free America, and we've got a ways to go to get there, but I'm optimistic. Right now in the United States, according to the USDA, about 37 million people do not have consistent access to a nutritious mix of food. That's a problem. It's especially challenging when I also have other statistics in my head, like the fact that about 72 billion pounds of perfectly edible food, not counting household waste, goes to landfills. I think we could do some better matching of those two things, Kai.
Yeah, I think we probably could. And we're going to get into that in a minute. But I do want to address the fundamental challenge that you have, which is that hunger is an acute situation, right? I need to feed my kids today. But also, if you want a hunger-free America, you are trying to treat a chronic problem.
Yes, that is correct. And at the inception of our movement, we focused almost all of our energy on the feeding side of things.
Right.
Now, we've evolved our strategy to include some really nuanced, complex issues to addressing what are the systemic issues that result in people being food insecure, and how might we find ways to help them on a path outside of food insecurity. It's not our objective, in other words, that people rely upon charitable food. We'd prefer that they have other resources.
Is it easier to do your work and to make your organization work, I suppose, when economic times are good or relatively good? And if so, how much are you worried about the current state of the economy?
Yeah, interestingly enough, it often is more challenging when people perceive that the economy is doing well. Yeah. If there's a public perception that the economy is doing well, there's also a public perception that we have to offset to begin with, which is that there aren't very many people who are facing hunger in America. People don't think America when they think hunger. They think distant shores. So we already have that hurdle. If you compound that hurdle with a perception that everything's going well, then people don't feel there's a need, and therefore they're not out there trying to find ways to be helpful. So raising awareness is a really big part of my job.
Claire Babineau-Fontenot, she is the CEO of Feeding America. Claire, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for yours.
We've got an extended version of that interview, including a discussion of the progress we have made on hunger in this country. Not enough, but some is the answer. It's on our Corner Office podcast. Speaking of podcasts, by the way, we've got one for this whole program. So does the Marketplace Morning Report and Marketplace Tech. So if there's news, maybe a story that starts with impeach and ends with mint that preempts us, say, starting the second week of January, a certain trial in the Senate of the United States, download us. Because remember, the economy doesn't wait. Here is a single sentence within which the modern music industry's business model is laid bare. Streaming and downloading account for something like 85% of total music sales, multi-billions of dollars worth. But that leftover 15%, there is still some upside. Vinyl's long, slow comeback continues, and business is brisk at the two dozen or so record-pressing companies that are still around, Archer Record Pressing among them. It's a no-frills, third-generation, family-owned shop making records for more than half a century. Stephen Cuevas from KPCC paid a visit.
Archer can be pretty easy to miss. A plain white and brown cinder block building tucked alongside machine shops and auto part makers on Detroit's east side. Oh, and that sound? It's not surface noise from a needle digging into the grooves of an old LP. It's Archer's steam boiler.
That's the boiler, yeah. It sounds like I've got a gasket that just sprung a leak. That's, like I said, it's always something. I'll be fixing that here shortly.
That's the founder's grandson, Mike Archer, who now runs the place, and the boiler. It generates steam for a fleet of vinyl pressers that can produce about 10,000 records a week, about as much as Archer can press. A minimum order of 200 costs around $800, more if a client wants colored vinyl. When Archer opened in 1964, it was pressing some of the greatest music to ever come out of Detroit, including the 1969 debut single of George Clinton's Funkadelic called Music for My Mother.
So I slowed down and took a listen. And this is all I could hear, baby. Whoa, hey! Whoa.
Out on Archer's workshop floor, it's all dirt, grease, and noise. A no-frills three-person factory that presses 8 hours a day. But the whole process starts with little bits of polyvinyl chloride.
And this is the raw material right here, these little colored pellets.
Yeah.
They look like rabbit food or something.
Yeah, that's how it starts, and then it gets melted in an extruder.
A lot of records pressed at Archer are now coveted by record nerds. Kanye West even put the label code from a classic 1970 gospel single pressed at Archer on the cover of his latest album. But Archer says the business never appealed to him as a kid.
You know, I liked music, but no, I didn't like making records. This is hard work, actually. You know, it's there are easier ways of making a living.
When Mike Archer agreed to help his dad out at the shop in the early 90s, he didn't understand who'd even be buying records after cassettes and CDs were in the picture. But Archer survived, thanks in part to underground music scenes.
Well, we were doing a lot of work for hip-hop artists and dance music, especially here in Detroit, the techno music.
My name is Brian Lackner. I rap under the name Mister. Yeah, I'm an MC from Detroit.
Lackner is swinging by Archer to scoop up boxes of his freshly pressed debut album.
There's been such a respect for Archer throughout the years. I felt like if I was going to have a release in Detroit, Archer is without question where I was going. Sometimes there is nowhere for you to go,
so left to deal with lots of water on your own. Lackner could have gone across town to Third Man Pressers, opened in 2017. It's doing well, too. Nationwide in 2018, vinyl record sales topped $419 million, according to the Recording Association of America. That's the highest since 1988. Turns out, even in the age of streaming and digital downloads, fans who prefer vinyl and are willing to shell out anywhere from $20 to $40 for a new album are boosting sales so much, vinyl is now close to overtaking what once nearly destroyed it, the digital compact disc. In Detroit, I'm Stephen Cuevas for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which you will think I am making up, but which I am not. The Department of Agriculture has a web tool called the Agricultural Tariff Tracker. And until today, when NBC News called them to ask him about it, you could look up tariffs imposed on goods imported to the United States from Wakanda. Wakanda from Black Panther, the Marvel movie. Yellow potatoes, 0.5 cents per kilogram is the tariff from Wakanda on those. Frozen Chinese water chestnuts, though, and cows, those are tariff-free. It's been fixed, but come on. Wakanda forever, am I right? Okay, we're going. Dow Industrial's down 27 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 both basically flat. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.